Today we are speaking with Yoav Shamir, the Israeli documentary filmmaker who has produced numerous award-winning documentaries. These include Checkpoint, which is a film that documented the experiences of Palestinians traveling through Israeli security checkpoints in the West Bank, as well as the experiences of the Israeli soldiers who were guarding those checkpoints. Most recently, Yoav has produced Defamation, which is a hard-hitting film on anti-Semitism that challenged many sacred cows. He's now working on a new film project called 10%, and he's running a crowd fundraising campaign to receive support for the final editing of that film. So, Yoav, if you could start by telling us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, there are a few people out there who, listening to this or who will read this, who probably don't know much about you. So for that 5%, could you just give us a little introduction?
Sure. I was born in Israel. My family has been here for many, many years. My parents are teachers, both of them in elementary school. They're retired now. And most Jewish Israelis have been to this kind of like very traditional route of high school, military service, traveling a little bit after the army. Then I studied history and philosophy, traveled some more, worked as a computer programmer. And when I was 30, you know, I thought I wanted to do something different with my life, and I started studying film. Took an MFA in film in Tel Aviv University, and started making films ever since.
That's great. One thing about Defamation that really struck me is interesting and kind of funny is your interview with your grandmother. I thought she was a lady with a lot of character, and I wanted to ask you, are her attitudes about Jews in the diaspora fairly representative of Israeli Jews of her generation or more generally?
I think her generation would be more sort of, her generation, she's like 95 years old, so there are not that many people still alive of her generation.
Right.
But I mean, if you think about, you know, sort of like the Zionists, the hardcore Zionists that moved to Israel from Europe when they were very young and had all these kind of like socialist ideas, and I mean, many of them were trying to build something new. I mean, it was a rebellion against the parents or against the great, the grandparents. And I mean, they wanted to start out something new. I mean, you have to remember it was a revolutionary sort of like movement. Also, you have to remember that Zionism was, I mean, when it started, it was very small, maybe 3% of all Jewish people in the world were Zionists. So it's, you know, it was kind of like a fringe movement, and fringe movements tend to be very radical in the way they look at the world, mostly. And I think they wanted to build, you know, something new. They wanted to build a community which is based on hard work and on socialism. And sort of, I mean, some of the thinkers, you know, were looking at, you know, the way Jews in Europe live, and, you know, and the way Europeans live is sort of like segregation. And they wanted to start fresh and be people of the land and all of these kind of things. So many things which were sort of associated with the old-fashioned Jewish life were seen as bad, as corrupted, and in that sense, she's very representative of this kind of school of thought.
Do you share any of her values today, and do younger Israelis, say under 40, have similar attitudes, or has that changed?
I mean, socialism, I mean, now it's kind of interesting that you're talking about that, because I think not only in Israel, but throughout the U.S. as well, and throughout many countries in Europe, socialism became sort of like, stopped to be like a bad word and started to be again, you know, something which is honorable. But I mean, for many years, you know, money was the king, and you know, whoever made money, I mean, was sort of like highly respected. I mean, capitalism in the U.S. is like, you know, it's a religion. So I mean, I wouldn't say that many Israelis think like Herod. That would not be correct to say. Mm-hmm.
What brought you to how did your desire to create the film Defamation come about, and how did you present the proposition to the Anti-Defamation League, because they really gave you unprecedented access into their organization, and people were able to see how that group functions, and I don't think they were quite prepared for the way that you presented it. But I'm curious about the background of how the film was started and how you made those proposals to these organizations.
The motivation for Defamation actually started with Checkpoint, when Checkpoint was released. And I started out making Checkpoint with having, you know, sort of like let's put it this way, I was approaching it more as a filmmaker than an activist or a lefty or, you know, all of these sort of like definitions. I was, you know, sort of like I was drawn into this human drama and this this conflict, this daily encounters, which had, you know, a lot of this kind of like psychological input to them. So, and I'm saying that because I think it's important to know that Checkpoint was not sort of like made by someone with very strong political convictions that knew, you know, that wanted to give a message. That was where I'm coming from. I was studying film. It started when I was a film student, and you know, it was just like I was fascinated with what was happening, and being in these checkpoints myself, it was very interesting for me to come back after a while. So it wasn't set up as sort of like a political statement, this film. And I think in a way that's what made this film as strong as it was, because I mean, there were Palestinians telling me that they've seen the film, you know, they had some empathy for the Israeli soldiers. Many Israelis, you know, were affected by, you know, by the way it was portrayed towards Palestinians. So, I mean, I think it touched many people because it was, you know, done mostly on this kind of like human, way of looking at things and not, you know, sort of like as a film that maybe an activist would make.
Right.
Would make. But then, I mean, the responses, especially from Jews in the U.S., was very harsh. I mean, in Israel, it was like, it got like pretty good, sort of like, cover and press. And, I mean, the film made a difference for many people. But then I started reading reviews about the film, and they were like very, very hostile. And, the extreme that, there were journalists referring to me as the Israeli Mel Gibson, accusing me of being anti-Semite. All of these things that for me were, you know, sort of like unbelievable. It was, you know, totally insane to hear these kind of things. Here I am, an Israeli, born and raised, done his military service, and, you know, have no issues with the fact that he's an Israeli and a Jew. He's been, you know, referred to as anti-Semite. And it kind of like blew me away. And then, then I started thinking about the whole sort of like concept of anti-Semitism. What does it mean? When is it being used? And then you see that it's all around. I mean, it's so present in the Israeli media, in the Jewish media, that, I mean, if I'm an anti-Semite, then what is anti-Semitism? I mean, it's kind of like something with the use of the word was bringing up questions. And that was a starting point for Defamation. And the Anti-Defamation League, and in a very similar way to Checkpoint, I came, you know, I came without knowing too much. I mean, normally when I work, I don't know too much about the subject I'm starting to work with, because then a lot of the things that I discover, if you know too much in advance, there's sort of like a lack of authenticity, a lack of energy. I mean, it's like proving a point. And I like to share with people watching the film, this sort of fresh look, this authenticity, this, things which are unfolding in front of the camera, and they're unfolding to me as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it doesn't take much to Google the anti-Semitism. I mean, ADL, you know, it's obviously the biggest organization fighting anti-Semitism. And then I approach them, telling them, you know, I want to see, you know, I want to learn what they're doing, how are they fighting anti-Semitism. And, I mean, and they said yes. I mean, I was, you know, they didn't run, you know, I guess, a very thorough background check. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't, I don't know, but they were like sort of like very open with me about everything. And again, I think I was very honest with them. I don't think I did not misled them in any way. It was kind of like funny, because when the film came out, the ADL spokesman was not working there anymore, obviously, but she told me that she thought, you know, it was a fair film. Foxman took it on a very, you know, sort of like different level, and took it as a very, you know, sort of like personal offense. But I was fortunate to be able to have this access, and this is always a good thing to have.
Right. Why do you think that your film was received so harshly abroad, but it was Checkpoint I'm referring to right now, why there was such a difference in opinion between the media outside of Israel and within Israel?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is like a very sort of like disturbed relationship between Israel or Israelis and Jews living abroad. I mean, here, you know, we things are happening here. People have different opinions about stuff. It's funny, you know, I'm saying that, but, you know, we have this kind of like terrible shift to the right in Israel in the last couple of years that, like, maybe all these things I'm saying, I'm going to be, people will listen to them in a while and say, wow, I mean, what is he saying? But, I mean, at least, you know, until last year, I mean, Israel is a very open place. I mean, you can criticize the government. You can, I mean, express opinions. We have newspapers, you know, from very right to very left, and, you know, it's all legitimate, and there is discussion. And I think there is something about, I think it's mostly American Jews, you know, you see it also in the UK, but I think that would be so the place where it happens most. Also, it's the biggest Jewish society or outside Israel, that they feel like Israel is like, I don't know, maybe like a retarded brother that needs protection or something like that, that they need to, you know, I mean, everything we do is right, and there's sort of like this, I don't know, some kind of like psychological mechanism of making sure that, you know, whatever is happening in Israel is not going to be portrayed in a bad light. And if there are problems, they should be sort of like washed internally and all these kind of things.
One of the people you interviewed in Defamation, a lady who worked for the ADL, referred to Israel as a child. You know, so in my view on things, I think American Jews may view Israel as a child that needs to be defended, and that might, you know, just as a mother would have natural biases toward her own children, I think, would you think it's possible that American Jews have, that there's a similar dynamic going on where they feel like they're obligated to rubber stamp any decisions that the Israeli government makes?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, in many of the times it happened like this. And I mean, the word which is being used also a lot is insurance policy. Israel is, you know, is our insurance policy. Mm. So, I mean, And we do have to remember that, especially for, you know, sort of like the older generation, the Holocaust is still very much something that is present in their lives. You know, if it's not them, so maybe the parents were survivors or had family of survivors. And I mean, this is like something that psychologically I can understand that. I mean, I can understand how somebody that was, I mean, always it's easy to take it, you know, this kind of analogies, you know, for like things we know from our daily life. So if someone as a child was beaten up and suffered, you know, so he's going to grow up and maybe teaching his kid, you know, that they have to stand up on the right and, you know, never let anybody arrest them or things like that. And so for many American Jews, they see it. I mean, they still see Israel as somewhere that needs to defend them and protect them. And if something bad happened, because I think many American Jews feel under this kind of thinking that, I mean, they live in a hostile place. And I mean, it's not in the film, but I mean, I was present on this kind of like actually very interesting ritual or game or whatever you want to call it, where Abe Foxman would, you know, would play this game with his, you know, ADL followers, and he would say, please think about 10 non-Jews of your friends that will save you in case, I mean, like this kind of like somebody's going to come knocking on the door. The reference, of course, is always like this kind of like SS officer knocking on the door. Mm. And then they cannot think about 10 names, and they say, okay, tell me 5 names. And they can't think of 5, and then it goes down to 3 and to 1, and you know, it's kind of this kind of ritual, this catharsis of everybody hates us, and you know, we need to take care of each other. So, I mean, I think for many American Jews, they live under this sort of fears, which, I mean, we might see them as imaginative, but for them, they're very real. I mean, because if you're a paranoid, you really think that someone is after you. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, what the real situation is.
Hmm.
And,
I was especially impressed with one of the segments in the documentary where you interviewed Norman Finkelstein, and he made the point that there's something sort of obscene about Jews who are a very wealthy, very powerful community in the United States, engaged in these kinds of thought experiments and ginning up this kind of feeling of constant siege and hysteria. And he talked about how there's a kind of shameful narcissism about that. And I was really struck by that statement. I want to ask you, a couple things about Israel and its neighbors. Do you think that it is ever going to be possible for Israel to have peaceful relations with its Arab neighbors? For Israel to have, you know, relations with its neighbors like the United States has with Canada, or, you know, Finland has with Sweden, you know, where they you know, live in a essentially casual and peaceful relationship where there's trade and interaction and basically amity. Do you think that's going to ever be possible? And how, if it would be possible?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough one. You know, I wish I could say yes, you know. And I mean, there were times where this was, you know, this kind of like, I mean, it was maybe never as relaxed and nice as, you know, the Scandinavian neighborhood. But there were times, I mean, my grandmother, which you see in the film, you know, we have like long conversations, and she was born here, her mother was born here, her grandfather was a soldier in the Turkish army, and then her father was, you know, in the British army, and, you know, and they used to travel here and travel there, and so there was some kind of like peaceful coexistence, and people could travel to Lebanon and to Syria and to Turkey, and it was, you know, this reality existed before.
Right. There are two sort of follow-ups I want to ask. One is related to this thought experiment that you were describing that Abraham Foxman does with his friends. Every people has a process where they form their sense of identity, and part of that process of forming their identity is to differentiate themselves from other people. I mean, Americans and Canadians think of themselves as different from one another, for instance, but it's a kind of innocuous difference. And it strikes me that it's tragic and an impediment to peace when you have very powerful organizations like the ADL or like the organization sponsoring these tours to Poland, to Auschwitz and other locations in Poland, that are forming the identities of Israelis and Jews in general in such a hostile way towards the rest of humanity. It just strikes me that it's going to be very, very difficult to have peace when that kind of enmity sense of past grievances is such a prominent place in the identity of people today. To give you an example, I was in India in 2004. I was in Varanasi, and I made a tour of a temple there, and the place was under heavy guard. You know, there were soldiers with machine guns everywhere. And next door, there was a mosque that had been built on the site of the temple. And this Hindu was giving me a tour, and he was talking about how the temple had been destroyed by Muslims and things like this. And he was describing this as if it just happened. And at a certain point, I realized that he was describing events that happened in the 17th century as if they were yesterday. And I just thought, how in the world, you know, can these people live at peace with one another when they're reliving, you know, these past conflicts like they just happened? And the other thing is, which is related, I guess, do you think a two-state solution within Israel / Palestine would be the way to having a more normal relationship with Palestinians within Israel's general larger borders and with your other Arab neighbors?
Ideally, I would say yes. I mean, if it was up to me, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think something like that would have to go to a referendum, you know, because I don't know what most Palestinians think about it. You know, maybe after what they've been through, they say, you know, fuck the Israelis. I don't know who we don't want to live with them.
Right. You know? Right.
So, I mean, looking at it, you know, from a humanist point of view, from, you know, a justice point of view, I would say yes. Realistically, I mean, it's, I think it's something that, if this decision is being accepted, you know, it has to be accepted on a sort of like a majority basis. And I don't know, like, who has the mandate to decide such a thing.
I think that there's a huge discontentment both in America and in Israel and really across the world about our leaders and about, you know, where our leaders are taking us, that they're not really well representing the interests of the people who they supposedly are leading. I saw something very inspirational the other day on Facebook. It seems that in 2011, with all the Arab uprisings, there's been a huge number of Arabs who have adopted Facebook, and I discovered a Facebook group that had the intention of forming a dialogue between Israeli Facebook users and Arab Facebook users about the peace process, but also about other matters, just to facilitate communication and to try to bridge this gap. I think the name of it is Yala Young Leaders or something to that extent. What do you think the prospects are for restarting the peace process just through having one-on-one direct dialogue?
I mean, getting to know the other person is, you know, is a must, you know, for in order for you to care about someone else, for you to not to see him, you know, in a way which is not totally stereotypic, you have to get to know people on a one-on-one basis. That's obvious. And it's also taking me to my new field, the 10%, which is, I mean, one of the things which, you know, all the activists we interviewed talked about was how crucial was this kind of like one-on-one meetings. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Arab world being open for Facebook is a great thing, because it creates a platform for dialogue. But then again, without leaders that will be able to sort of like do something with it and take it forward, nothing's going to happen. And I mean, it's kind of like dialogue is great, but all of us are, you know, very, very impatient, you know, like even dialogue is going to start now. We don't want to see peace in 50 or 100 years. We want to have peace now. So, I mean, for that to happen, I mean, there's need to be some kind of a leadership which is firm, is the way they see things, the way they're like, they're willing to take risks, willing to take chances, to believe in peace, all of these kind of things. And that can only take, can have, really realistically talking can only happen through, you know, some kind of more conventional political systems.
Mm-hmm. Do you see the social justice protests that have taken place across the globe against crony capitalism, and here in America, the Occupy movement against the 1%? You know, I know that there's also a summer movement in Israel along the same lines. Do you see those movements as facilitating the peace process, a greater desire for accountability from leaders to move forward on initiatives that are started through dialogues between peoples?
Yeah, I mean, taking the examples of, I don't know, even like Israel and the U.S., I mean, this sort of like taking on capitalism in a way which is going to be sort of like fertile in the U.S., I don't know, it's like you really have to break down everything and sort of like restart it. I mean, your whole society is not based on, you know, this kind of like, the structure of socialist society like you see in North Europe or what it used to be in Israel. So, I mean, for this to happen, I mean, it's a huge thing. I mean, it's great that people are out there and are protesting and, but I don't know. I really want to be so optimistic and think that it will lead somewhere. But I know that it's doing that is going like against. I mean, it will almost like require a revolution, and I don't see like a revolution is happening in the U.S. And same thing in Israel. I mean, we had all these protests and I mean, and nothing happened with it. You know, like. It started about protest about the price of housing, and you know it just kept going up. And I mean, it was almost a way, like a cynical way of the government of let its citizens do some kind of like reventilate, or I don't know, like to take out some steam. And now what? Now what's gonna happen? I mean.
Mm-hmm.
What will happen in the U.S.? What will happen in Israel with that? I don't know. It's
Maya.
Something good will come out of it, but I mean,
my feeling about the Occupy movement is that it really does seem to be designed only to let off steam, because it doesn't really have any goals or program over and above just having camps and having protests. And so it seems to be a great way of getting people to expend a lot of energy and get a lot of anger out of their system without actually changing the system. I wanted to ask one more question about defamation. And that is this. Did anyone accuse you or criticize you for not trying very hard to actually interview anti-Semites? because there are some very articulate American critics of Jews, for instance, somebody like David Duke or Kevin MacDonald, and there are legions of colorful kooks out there on the internet that you could get a hold of fairly easily. Did anyone say, well, you didn't try very hard, because really the only actually anti-Semitic characters that appeared in the documentary were those black people that you interviewed in Brooklyn. And that was a very interesting segment, by the way.
And my grandmother.
And I guess your grandmother, yeah.
Of course. That was, you know, one of the main, you know, criticism that I had. And you know what? It's kind of funny, because if I wanted to make like a sequel about defamation, you know, I was like, I became like a target for, you know, for many anti-Semites to share their views with me. All of those that say the Holocaust never happened. And I mean, I just had like a very sad email from a Catholic priest, like one of these evangelists, that explained to me that I will rot in hell, you know, if I won't convert. And, you know, so I mean, in a way, the research, you know, sort of like was a very easy research, but I had to do the film first.
Right.
And, also, people were like asking me, why didn't you go to the Arab world? And but in a way, it wasn't, you know, sort of like this kind of like lunatic fringe, you know, it's like this easy target. They, you know, they come good on camera. You know, they like to be provocative, but it would have been a too easy task in a way. And the film was, you know, mostly sort of like about perception and about how we perceive and how we choose to perceive. And I mean, personally, my own view is that, I mean, obviously there are anti-Semites out there. I think there are many more people who hate blacks and Muslims than there are people who hate Jews. You know, that's also, I think, like the reality, if you want to sort of like really send the record straight. But the question is, how do you, you know, choose to deal with the world? How do you choose to relate to things? And I had a very, it's not in the film, you know, the film like had also a very long research. I had a very interesting conversation with a Syrian guy living in Vienna. And there's a huge Muslim community in Vienna. And I mean, they have, if you compare it to sort of like the anti-Semitism that exists in Austria compared to the Islamophobia that exist in Austria. So I mean, I think their situation is much worse than the Jewish what the Jews are experiencing. And he was telling me, you know, I asked him why don't you have this kind of like system of reporting, of monitoring everything that the Jewish people do so well, and I mean, why don't you kind of like use all these methods to fight Islamophobia. He told me, you know, I think it's going to be counterproductive to do it. I think, and he gave me the example of, you know, just like someone going to the grocery store and there's like an Orthodox Jews coming in, and some people, you know, they might want to say something, but they're not going to say anything. And when he's going to leave the story, when he's going to, you know, talk about it, well, maybe with the Muslim is going to be sort of like a straightforward confrontation. And I mean, sometimes confronting things will result in getting over things. And I mean, it's a way, how do you choose also to be portrayed? Do you choose to be portrayed as a victim? Do you choose to put your victimhood on a pedestal? Or do you want to sort of like get on with your life and move forward? And I mean, you can look at it as a philosophy, as a way to, how do you want to deal with the world? The way I like to deal with the world is that sometimes you just have to move forward, and it's better to swallow, you know, to take a hit, you know, like once in a while, you know, to become this person or people that define the whole sort of existence around it. But that's just my view.
I just want to go back to what you were saying earlier about living in victimhood in the past. You know, I heard something recently that I thought was very wise about forgiveness. You know, I grew up a Roman Catholic, and eventually I got pretty tired of the notion of turning the other cheek. I viewed it as a form of weakness, you know, of just making yourself submissive and to your attackers. But a different way of looking at it is to forgive somebody, not to justify what they've done to you or the wrongs they've done, but rather to not allow them to torment you in the present, to, you know, put them out of your mind and be able to free yourself from emotional and psychological torments that prevent you from acting and thinking accurately about what you need to do in the present. I'm curious now as to your new film, 10%, if you'll tell us a little bit about that and what you hope to accomplish.
Yeah, 10% is my new documentary. Basically, it's a film that asks what makes a hero. Mm-hmm. We see situations around us, I mean, whether it's war or terror or, you know, just a mundane situation where people are in distress, and there's always a minority that helps, while most people don't help. So what makes them different? Is there something different in the way these people grew up, or is there, you know, something in their personality, in their genetic code, whatever? And I mean, examples would be, you know, for like sort of like examples that I grew up with was, I mean, those like few Germans that helped Jews during the Holocaust, what we call in Israel like the righteous Gentiles. Or if you think about whites of Africans coming from Africans' family, you know, like very, you know, well, most of their society was, you know, sort of like very pro-apartheid. There were like few of them who joined the ANC. I mean, so why them? Well, the majority didn't. You can even look at it as, I don't know, someone is drowning in a river and, you know, there might be, I don't know, 10 people watching, but only one will jump into the river and save this person. So this is kind of like the basic question, why some people are different the most people, what makes them be the way they are. The film has sort of like a few storyline, but I mean, one of the main storyline, we're following a research that is done by Professor Philip Zimbardo, which is the person that did the Stanford Prison Experiments, which was based on the Milgram obedience experiments. And these two psychological experiments from the 60s and 70s showed how the majority, you know, is very easily seduced to evil or to authority. And it was, you know, sort of like experiments that really made people wonder about the nature of evil and about all of the situations and these kind of things. But what they sort of like overlooked or neglected to look was they never asked, who were the people who did not cooperate? Who were the people who did not sort of like were seduced to evil in the Stanford Prison Experiment, or who did not sort of like were refusing to electroshock the fellow man in the obedience experiment? And so he set out, Professor Zimbardo set out on a new research to try to explore this minority, what he called the 10%. And he's doing it with a team of Palestinian and Israeli psychologists, and they're examining three focus groups. In the U.S., it's ex-gang members that were once part of this very violent gangster life, and now they're not only quit the gang, but they're trying to help other young people get out of the gang. And in Israel, they're talking about people that used to be sort of like very militaristic, and maybe, you know, some of them coming from families of settlers or this type of people who are now joined, you know, the radical left peace movements. And same thing in Palestine, people that used to be part of the armed struggle and are now into cooperating with Israelis, and doing it in a non-violent way. So this is the research that they're doing. I'm following the research, and I'm setting out to different very interesting detours on my own. And as it is with most of my films, you know, I have a lot of questions. I'm challenging the research, you know, quite a lot, and the researchers. And but in a way, it's sort of like an exploration into the human soul, into what makes us good or what makes us bad. And so far, it's been a fascinating journey.
So where are you filming this? Are you filming this in various places around the world, like you did with Defamation? Or?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is shot in the U.S., Palestine, Israel, but we've been to South Africa, we've been to Congo, we've been to, we've been to quite a few places. Probably the easiest way is to check out our website or the Indiegogo website, and there are clips and trailers and these kind of things that give like a better understanding of what we're doing.
What's that web address?
If you log on to Indiegogo, which is this crowdfunding website, so Indiegogo.com, and then you just search 10%, that will take you there. If you want, you can, obviously become my Facebook friend, and just Yoav Shamir, look me up, Yoav Shamir, or Yoav Shamir Films, and then there is a reference to the film and to the Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign, and I'm quite easy to track on Facebook, on Google. I'm pretty available, as you guys noticed.
Yes.
I'm curious as to the relationship. I'm assuming it's a pretty strong relationship, but there is the whole idea of social conformity, and that in any group, Nietzsche referred to it as the herd instinct, that most people in a social group will conform to the prevailing opinions of other people in that group, rather than think independently and come to their own independent decisions about whether to take a certain action. Is that concept equivalent to the 10% that you're researching? Have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at, a specific group of people that, under my definitions, they're heroes. So these are people that are willing to risk their life or pay sort of like a considerable toll. And they're doing it in order to help someone from another group. From, what the psychology term is, out-group. I mean, we have like our in-group, which can be as small as our nuclear family, our, friends, the people, in our like sort of like social circles, or people in our town or in our country, and you have the out group, which is people outside of this group. The enemy, normally become is an out group.
Right.
So I'm, and especially it's kind of interesting to look at people that were like once members of a very defined group. I mean, let's take South Africans, like of Africans backgrounds. I mean, these people during the apartheid era, it was like a small, close community, with very sort of like strong convictions about the world, and supporting apartheid was a major part of their identity. So to grow up in such a place, and to be able to identify with your enemy, with, it's not only an enemy, it's someone that you see as inferior to you. As not worthy, and manage to take this step, and then risk losing your friends, risk going on exile, risk going to prison, risk going to risk losing your life, in order to help these people from this other group. For me, this is heroism. This for me like sort of like the ultimate expression of altruism, and these are the people that I'm interested to find out about in the film. I mean, we're looking at different, in the film, which is also kind of like, it has a lot of humor in it, and it has, there's like a lot of, it's kind of like it I'm trying to tell it in a lighthearted sort of like way. I'm overruling sort of like or examining, you know, different type of terrorism and but eventually these are the people that I'm most interested about, because I think eventually these are people who change the world and making the world a better place. And these are the people that I think need to be examined and learned. I think it's kind of interesting to have this tool that psychology or science provide us to question, you know, their motives and to see whether there are some, you know, like a blueprint, a psychological blueprint or a genome or common patterns that we can understand something about these people.
Right.
And in the film, you know, and in the research, you know, there are some very, very interesting answers and hypotheses that come out and examples. And the great thing about the film is, like, we sort of, like, we also have this kind of, like, groups which are operating now. So, I mean, it's not, we not only look at people that used to do it before, and, like, we're experiencing people who are doing it as we live, as we speak right now. And this is kind of, like, it's great as a filmmaker to be able to follow things as they happen. And also, it's good for the research, I mean, so, because people are very sort of, like, it's still very, still going on. So, I mean, the sacrifice is real. The situations are real. The danger is real. So, I mean, it's a great challenge for me as a filmmaker, and it's a great pleasure as well.
Mm. I'm curious about this dynamic between the in-group and the out-group. Here in the U.S., and I imagine across the world, there is a tendency among the liberal left to say that we're all human beings, and that differences between individuals and between groups, between races, between religions, that those aren't very important. I take a different view. I think that it's important to maintain a healthy sense of identity, and to love yourself, love your group, your family, your people. And I believe that because when you look at individuals who have a healthy sense of self-respect and self-esteem, their capacity to love and have positive interactions with others is increased rather than decreased. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on that. Also, the history of the Jewish people is one of a high level of ethnocentrism as well. And I'm curious as to whether you think that is a healthy thing or an unhealthy thing.
You know, it's not so important, I think, whether it's healthy or not healthy, or, I mean, it's just the way it is. I mean, people people are fans of sports team, and you will refer in a different way to someone that you know that speaks your language, that you grew up with, that you share, like, sort of, like, similarities either in look or in thought. And I mean, so it's I mean, we're all humans, we all, you know, should love each other, but realistically there are always going to be this kind of like people divide themselves to groups. So I mean, it doesn't matter, you know, what I think about it exists, and I think it will go on, you know, for until, you know, we sort of like face a common enemy that will be strong enough to sort of like unite us together. You know, I mean, we need some extraterrestrials, you know, to do that. But I mean, as long as, you know, they don't come in and attacking us, I mean, so I mean, there's going to be people going to, you know, sort of look at themselves and in groups, in tribes. So I think this is just the way things are.
So that's not a problem per se, that people are, you know, have this natural human tendency to divide themselves. Rather, how people deal with it is what you're focusing on in this film.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just asking, you know, in this film, like, how come very few people, and mostly it's you know, 10%, you know, it's probably like a very sort of like optimistic number.
Yeah. That was my thought, actually.
Especially here with 99% versus the 1% they occupy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, the interesting thing is why certain people will, you know, will stand up. Mm. What makes them different? And I wish everybody would stand up, you know, everybody would say something different, but unfortunately it's not the case.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish I could call this film, you know, like 50-50 or 7 or 80 or whatever. I mean, but 10%, you know, at least I'm not being like totally pessimistic about the world.
Right.
But I think it's very interesting to ask why. And I think what's interesting in the film that it makes you challenge yourself. What would I do in a certain situation?
Yeah.
How would I react? What would be my response? You know, I've never seen myself as a huge altruistic, you know, like having like an altruistic personality. Try to be like a decent person, but I mean, and I can tell you that, you know, making this film sort of like, you know, it forces you to sort of like deal with things, to think about them, and I think it's a very important step even to be thinking about these things, you know, to make a movement, to make a shift. Same as all, you know, this kind of like, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with, you know, Occupy Wall Street or with, you know, all these kind of demonstrations that happen in Israel or other places, but I mean, at least it's out there. You're talking about it. You're discussing it. I mean, it's a first step for a change. And in that sense, it's great.
We are seeing constituencies form, but, you know, the question is, will there be people to come along and lead them and actually make change out of them? What is your pet theory about why people are willing to stand up to social pressure and social conformity? Based on your own experience, because obviously you're a person who's been willing to stand up and take some heat, what makes that possible for you? What makes you tick?
I think the main thing that sort of like, and I don't want to give like too many spoilers for the film, because, you know, I do want people to eventually watch the film, but I mean, when there is sort of like what we call, I don't know if I'm using the right English word for it, a dissonance.
Dissonance, yeah.
Yeah. Between the way you look at the world, the way you perceive the world, and the way the world is. When the clash is too big, some people, you know, they can't live with that. They need to do something. They cannot not do something about it. And this is mostly the I think in the group that I'm interested in, this is like the sort of the thing that leads to action. This dissonance between how you perceive the world and how the world is. The question is why certain people develop this, you know, this what I see is like it's a very healthy way of looking at the world, you know, without being influenced, you know, by a certain conduct of behavior or the way the society is expecting them to behave, and you manage to break out of the circle. This is, you know, this is what leads people to act. When you see something and there's a voice inside you that tells you it's wrong and I cannot stand it. You know, I cannot not do something about it.
Well, I don't want you to give away any spoilers either, but you've certainly given us a lot of teasers, and I'm really very eager to see the final product. So, Yoav, thank you so much for giving us your time and your ideas and your insights on these things. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much, Yoav.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you guys.